My guest is Dr. Sally Perry. She is Executive Director of the Sinclair Lewis Society, and we're talking about the novel It Can't Happen Here by Sinclair Lewis, something that several of our listeners probably have at least heard referred to if they haven't picked it up and read it again. Dr. Perry, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. I'm absolutely fine.
This book by Sinclair Lewis was written when?
1935.
What were the surrounding events that made him feel like he needed to say, look, this is happening and it can happen, and worry about it?
Well, you know, there are some similarities today, although I think the country in general is in better economic shape than it was back then. I mean, and the novel came out in 1935, which was in the heart of the Great Depression, so as much as 20% of the American public was unemployed, there was another huge percent that was underemployed, and so we have a lot of unemployment. We have the rise of fascism in Germany, in Austria, in Italy, the rise of militarism with Japan in the Far East. And then we had finished fighting World War I only about 15 years before. So it was a very scary time.
So Sinclair Lewis created this character named, I'm going to go with Buzz Windrip. He had a different name,
sure.
Berzelius or something like that. And another character, which I think is important for us to discuss, and that would be the man's name was Lee Saracen, who was kind of the man behind the man as far as politics are concerned.
Yeah, you know, in thinking about it and thinking about the sort of outsized role that Steve Bannon has taken on recently, there are a lot of connections between him and Lee Saracen. You know, Windrip in the novel is somebody who has some rather popular ideas, very similar to, you know, America First, Make America Great Again, whatever, but not a lot of real concrete ways of how to carry them out. And Lee Saracen in the novel is sort of the man behind the throne, so to speak. He's the one who actually creates the campaign biography and so forth. And I think that, you know, there are many correlations one can see between him and Steve Bannon right now.
So let me ask you this. Who's going to play the role of, and I'll probably get the first name wrong, I know his wife called him Dormouse, but it's like Dormus Jessup. Who will play
Jessup?
Yeah, who will play Jessup's role in this story?
Well, I think every American ought to be in the role of Doremus Jessup, because in a sense, what Lewis is doing is writing it's kind of an education for Lewis as an author, as well as Doremus Jessup, the character, who assumes, I think, like many Americans, that, you know, regardless of who gets elected, the country will kind of go along, and, you know, there might be some changes in policies or whatever, but the country itself is pretty sound. And then it's only when it's way too late that he realizes that democracy is more fragile than he expected, and that had he and other people paid more attention, it might not have happened here. And so I think one of the lessons that Lewis hopes that everybody would come away with is to, you know, be educated about the political system and stay involved in the political process, whether that actually means running for office or voting or contacting your representatives or signing petitions. I mean, there are many different ways to get involved, but not just to sort of sit back and hope things work out.
Dr. Sally Perry is our guest. She's executive director of the Sinclair Lewis Society. Is there anything that would give you any insight into Sinclair Lewis as to how he would feel our country having survived? I mean, he lived up until, I can't remember when he died, but I think he was writing up to the 50s or so, was he not?
He died in 1951.
So 1951. Now, is he, if you could conjure up his spirit and say, what do you think about what's happening now and how people are starting to gravitate toward your book, It Can't Happen Here? What are your thoughts? Do you think you could guess as to what he might be thinking?
Well, you know, I think he might say, "I told you so." You know, one of the things, you know, sometimes I wish that It Can't Happen Here were just kind of a historical curiosity rather than speaking so much to the tenor of our time. But, you know, I think that Lewis had a real sense of what Americans were like deep down. You know, one time he said, "I love America, but I don't like it." And I think by that, he truly meant that he was, you know, The values that America was based on, were very important, but the way that they get carried out. People get scared. They get greedy. And so they don't always act on the best interests of the country because they don't see sort of beyond their own needs. And when you get sort of an autocratic type person, whether we're talking Buzz Windrup or Donald Trump, who says, okay, great, I'll make it so that it'll all work out for you, and people buy into this, you know, the terrible things can happen.
One of the phrases that I wrote down, and I oftentimes do this, and it came early in the book, something about the candidate, or I don't know if he was even officially a candidate at that time, something about giving molasses for the cockroaches. Basically, I'll say something sweet, knowing that people will gravitate to that, and that will be like molasses for the cockroaches. That's a really good line.
Lewis, you know, had a really good sense of humor. So there's a real sense of sarcasm throughout that he knew that, well, you know, as Barnum said, there's a sucker born every minute. And there are people who, like, you know, will gravitate to the things that they like to hear.
Yeah,
so in the novel, there's the forgotten men. And Windrup says, you know, you guys will all get jobs and you'll get paid really well. And they say, terrific. I mean, they don't think of what the implications are for that to take place, but they're sucked into it. And, you know, any kind of get-rich-quick scheme, I think, appeals to a certain segment of the population.
One of the other things that showed his humor, but at the same time was kind of a poignant and made me a little melancholy, was the fact that talking about Jessup, who was a newspaper man, I think in one point in time he said something about writing an editorial. And it would be one of those editorials that would be talked about maybe from noon, 10 to noon, and then forgotten by 6. You know, and I think that's a pretty good statement about what I believe we could be fearful of when we have so much bombarding us as far as amount of information that it is hard to contemplate it, to consider it, to let it sit there for a while and then motivate us to certain attitudes or actions.
I think that's very true, because I think that one of the things that the book sort of tells us is that you have to think about the implications of the actions that are being taken, and too often you don't. And I mean, I think it's, you know, especially now with all of the media. You know, back then it was primarily radio and newspapers and so forth, but you know, now we have Twitter and the internet and all that sort of thing. And it becomes hard to find out where the truth lies—not the alternative facts, but where the truth really lies—and then to make sense of it before something else happens. And so, I think that many people become overwhelmed and, you know, and very despairing, because there's just so much. How do you deal with it in any rational way, rather than hiding under the bed, for example?
We're going to run out of time shortly, but again, in this book, we hear the message that the press will lie. We also hear the message through the candidate, and this comes right after he is an official candidate for the Democratic Party, the 15 points of victory for the forgotten men. And if you read that closely, it's kind of interesting, because you go through several. Some of them would resonate today. Some of them do not resonate very well today. And you get to number 15, which is, everything I do is going to have the power. Congress, you don't even have any power anymore. And later on in the book, I believe that comes to fruition. But you read that and you say, wow, what an insight into the political mind going back to 1935. So I don't know whether I should feel better at the fact that this was a threat that was perceived by at least Sinclair Lewis and others at that time, and it hasn't yet come to fruition, or if I should see this as a harbinger of the times we live in now.
Ooh, I hope the former.
Yeah, I do too.
The propensity for people to believe in somebody that will save them is, you know, just so close to the surface. And I think it's incumbent upon every citizen to stay part of the political process, so that hopefully this sort of thing can't happen here.
Anything you want to leave us with when you think, I've seen these statistics of to the increase in sales of It Can't Happen Here, well over 1,000% increase, and I think sometimes over 2,000 or 3,000% increase in the number of copies of this book that has been rediscovered or discovered now. Any final thought for us?
If you haven't read the book, you ought.
It is.
I think that's the thing to say is that, you know, read this, read Orwell's 1984, read Margaret Atwood's A Handmaid's Tale, because they all talk about dystopian futures. And the more you know, I think the better armed you are to deal with unsettling things in politics.
I appreciate those words, Dr. Perry. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you very much for having me on.